good to express my appreciation to Terry for teaching my Wednesday night class while I was away, and for all of you in participating in that class so well. In our study tonight, we want to notice the significance of Christ's priesthood. A major theme in the Hebrew epistle is the priesthood of Christ. In the second chapter of the book of Hebrews, we were introduced in verse 17, where there the text says, "Wherefore it behooved him in all things to be made like unto his brethren, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in all things," or in things pertaining to God, "to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself hath suffered, being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted." Here we are introduced to the theme of the priesthood of Christ in the book of Hebrews. In the third chapter, and in verse 1, it says, "Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, even Jesus. He is priest or high priest of our confession. He is also a great high priest who has passed through the heavens." We learned in Hebrews the fourth chapter and in verse 14. He is also described in verse 15 as a sympathetic high priest, one that can be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, in all points like as we are, yet without sin. He is also called as priest, or as a priest who came from God, in Hebrews chapter 5 and in verses 5 and 6. "So Christ also glorified not himself to be made a high priest, but he that spake unto him, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. As he saith also in another place, Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And by the way, where is this Old Testament quotation from? Anyone tell me? "Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." It's one we want to be familiar with because it's stated a number of times in the Hebrew letter. Psalms 110, yes, Psalms 110, verse 4. So Christ is called a high priest, and his calling came from God. He is a unique priest in that he is not a priest according to the Levitical priesthood. He is not a priest after the order of Aaron. His priesthood is not that which began with the giving of the law through Moses at Mount Sinai. His priesthood, as we noticed in verses 5 and 6 of the 5th chapter, and also in verses 9 and 10 of the 5th chapter, his priesthood is that as the order of Melchizedek. Now, in our previous studies, we've noted who Melchizedek was in his relationship to Abraham, and we've noted that he was superior to Abraham. How do we know that? What was the relationship between Abraham and Melchizedek? Roy? All right, Abraham did. That's right. Abraham paid tithes. Randy? All right, what is the second side of that? Melchizedek blessed Abraham. That's right. So he received tithes from Abraham, and he blessed Abraham. And even Levi, in the loins of his ancestor Abraham, paid tithes to Melchizedek. Isn't that true? Showing the superiority of Melchizedek's priesthood over Abraham, and thus over the Levitical priesthood. Now, that Jesus would come to serve as a high priest after the order of Melchizedek is not without some very significant and some very major implications. Number one, regarding the efficacy of the Levitical priesthood, and number two, regarding the law of Moses itself. If that Old Testament priesthood was not that which would bring about completeness or perfection for the people of God, it's reflective upon the law itself, and we want to see how. Some of the significant and significance and implications of Christ's priesthood is described in these verses that we want to study tonight, beginning at verse 11. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 11. It says, "Now if there was perfection through the Levitical priesthood, for under it hath the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned after the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. For he of whom these things are said belongeth to another tribe, from which no man hath given attendance at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord has sprung out of Judah, as to which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priests. And what we say is yet more abundantly evident. If after the likeness of Melchizedek there ariseth another priest, who hath been made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life. For it is witnessed of him, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Let's pause there in the reading of the text. What we want to notice is the significance of this change that's being discussed in these verses. The Levitical priesthood, according to verse 11, was lacking. But lacking in what respect? It says, for if there had been perfection through the Levitical priesthood, what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned after the order of Aaron? That's a legitimate question. If there was perfection under the Levitical priesthood, why would there be need for another priesthood? Now the question is, what perfection is he talking about that did not exist under that Old Testament system? Roy, you had a comment or a question? That's right. That Old Testament system did not provide that in completeness.
Also, the Old Testament priests had to first make atonement for their own sins before they atoned for the sins of the people.
All right, and that's certainly in contrast to the priesthood of Christ that we see discussed at verses 26 and the following few verses. Terry and then David. Yes. Yes, we want to look at that. Turn, if you will, to chapter 10, verses 1 through 4.
There are about 3 points there in those first 4 verses.
Yes. It says, for the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, not the very image of the things, can never with the same sacrifices year by year which they offer continually make perfect them that draw nigh. Else would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would have had no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices there is remembrance made of sins year by year. For it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sins. Before I go with that, David, go ahead.
Well, my comment was that the Levitical priesthood was never meant to be completed. It was never the end product. It was Christ's priesthood. It was always.
All right.
It was intended to be completed perfection.
All right, but it did serve a purpose. It pointed to the coming of something better. While we're open there to the 10th chapter, Terry.
I mean, there was really, the Levitical priesthood was really, you might say, a type of Christ.
Well, that's right. It served to point to the coming of something better. Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 10, Hebrews 10, verse 1. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, not the very image of the things, can never with the same sacrifices year by year which they offer continually make perfect them that draw nigh. Two things. One is that these Old Testament sacrifices did not make perfect or did not make complete. A second thing we want to notice is that those Old Testament sacrifices were offered continually, year by year by year by year by year. On the Day of Atonement, those sacrifices had to be offered. But for what purpose, what function did they serve? In verse 2, that's the question that's asked. They didn't make perfect, or else, he said, would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshipers, having been once cleansed, would have had no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is remembrance made of sins year by year. Those Old Testament sacrifices that were offered by those priests served a valid purpose, and that is to remind them that they were guilty of sin. Go ahead.
It is just like the illustration of one particular loan that the California City Redevelopment Agency has, where every year it makes a payment on that loan. But because of the nature of that loan, the payment's only paying interest, and it's never touching the principal.
All right.
And so that, likewise, those sacrifices under the old law were only paying never against the principle of forgiving sin.
All right, that's right. And what's happening all along, year by year, with the principle itself?
Remembrance.
All right, but it's getting bigger.
It's getting, yeah, the interest is improving.
Yes, and the reason is more sin is being committed. And so you have payment made only on the interest, while at the same time the principal is increasing. And so that's kind of a no-win situation, which helps us to see, as Paul said, the exceeding sinfulness of sin, which helps us to see our need for something that will take away sin. Okay, appeasement.
Taking away the wrath of God.
Yes.
And my next, what would call the appeasement? I'm not sure if I totally understand here the have a more consciousness of sin. So, under those sacrifices, you just mentioned another phrase for that, being reminded of sin.
Yes, in verse 2, it says, or verse 3, but in those sacrifices there is a remembrance made of sins year by year. Going back to Terry's illustration, when the payment is made on the interest, what are you reminded of, if not the principal debt? Now, the problem with this is the debt is getting larger and larger and larger and larger as sin continues to be committed. But the interest is only... what's being paid is only the interest. So this situation is getting out of hand, you see, rapidly. And that's what the writer is trying to help us to see. That was one of the purposes of those Old Testament sacrifices, to prepare for a supreme sacrifice that would indeed take away sin. Okay, Terry, and then David, and then Judy.
Yeah, we can see the contrast there. What the writer is pointing out in the 10th chapter of Hebrews, that there's a consciousness about the sin that's
thus a lack of perfection.
Thus a lack of perfection. We can contrast that, I believe, with Acts 3 and 19.
Okay.
That repent ye therefore and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out. So they're going to be blotted out. They're going to be remembered no more. Illustrated by when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord.
All right.
Sins have been forgiven. They're remembered no more.
No more consciousness.
No more consciousness
of sin. That's right. So there are two or three major points in Hebrews 10 that we want to be reminded of. Number one, that is, perfection could not be made according to those things that were types and shadows. That didn't provide the forgiveness of sins. And then number two, those Old Testament sacrifices did have a purpose. The purpose was to... remind them of the severity of their condition. Okay, Joey, hang on. I got David, and then I got Judy, and then Joey. Oh, certainly so. We have a supreme priesthood, and that's the point that's being established here. We have a supreme priesthood that works to take away sin.
Therefore, more comfort.
More comfort. Freedom from the consciousness of sin. That's right. Judy?
I'm lost for the word. The difference between the sacrifice of animals and Christ brings sin more, personal or...
Yes. Worse? Yes. And why was it necessary that we have a human sacrifice versus an animal sacrifice? Why didn't God just arrange it where that the blood of animals would take away sins?
Choice.
All right, choice.
Human
committed sin, and therefore it required a human sacrifice. All right,
yeah.
Terry?
Yeah, the animals didn't commit
it. That's right. It wasn't the animal that sinned. It was man that sinned, and therefore man had to pay the penalty. Joey?
This verse that says that it was this constant remembrance from year to year, I rather view that as like a black cloud hanging over them continually. mean, that's really the concept in our mm-hmm. common vernacular today. There's this constant black cloud hanging over them because of the inferiority of the sacrifices.
Well, that's right.
Compared to Christ. But Christ's sacrifice literally makes the black cloud go away.
It does.
What you were saying as far as now our conscience is clear. And that is borne out in the fact that all these verses are saying we have a better law. That shows its superiority and that our consciousness can be completely clean. That sin is just not temporarily rolled over to the next year. It's truly done away with.
Well, that's right. So seasons of refreshing, as we were looking at in Acts chapter 3. All right, David?
Yeah, the constant reminder was important to the Jewish nation to remind them that Messiah was coming. There was a congregation, it was a small congregation, and a very small parking lot. It was a grocery store next door. They were going like, oh, it was a small one, but the owner of the grocery store told the church that they could use the, you know, grocery store parking lot. All the time, except one Sunday every year, he would let them use it. And that was just to remind him that it was his, and take care of it, and not throw trash and stuff down. So it reminded them that they didn't own that. It was a privilege to get to use it. And once a year, he would let them use it. One Sunday every year, he would let them use it.
That's interesting.
To keep them refreshed, remembrance
yeah.
that it wasn't theirs.
All right, that's interesting. When we think about perfection in this text, what kind of perfection is being discussed? For if there was perfection through the Levitical priesthood. David?
The Greek term means to bring to an end, to bring to completion, or bring to maturity.
All right, that's exactly what we're looking for, to bring to completion. We'll use that for our purposes tonight. So those Old Testament sacrifices offered by that Old Testament priesthood did not make perfect in the sense it did not bring to completeness the relationship of the sinner to God. Now, let's talk for just a moment. What function did the priests actually serve, the priests themselves? What did they do?
Move sin forward to the temple.
All right, the sacrifices did that, but what was the function of the priest, Randy? To be a mediator. That's right. He was the man that stood between men and God. Now, the fact that he couldn't offer a sacrifice sufficient to do the job reflects not only upon the sacrifice, but upon him, because he too was guilty of sin, Jenny, as you pointed out, as we see contrasted to the high priest that we now have, Jesus the Christ, beginning at verse 26. We'll hold that thought for just a moment. But I want to go back to verse 11 once again. For if there was perfection through the Levitical priesthood, for under it hath the people received the law. That's a parenthetical statement that just seems to be dropped out of the air right into this text. Under it, that is, under the Levitical priesthood, hath the people received the law. There's a relationship between the law and the priesthood, is there not? What was that relationship? Terry, you're grinning. Go with it. That's right.
Or foundational to the law.
All right, that's right.
The law of Moses stood or fell on the Levitical priesthood.
That's right. And that's the contrast the writer is trying to get us to see, that this Levitical priesthood was that which undergirded the law itself. And if this priesthood was lacking in anything, so likewise the law was lacking. Now, Joey's got a puzzled look. Okay, you're okay with that then. All right. Okay. Now that's important to the text of the Hebrew letter because this contrast is something that's seen throughout. And the writer's now trying to get us to see the lack of efficacy, I guess is the only word I know to describe it, the lack of effectiveness of that Old Testament priesthood. It's seen in the law itself. That law did not make provision for the sinner once he had transgressed God's law. Okay, David?
And this is brought out through the whole book of Hebrews too, where it talks about, well, here it talks about the law that was not perfect, it was not complete, did not make it complete. And then you have verses like 2:10 where it talks about the author of Christ being perfectly suffering, and then other places it talks about Christ being perfect or complete salvation.
Hebrews 5, 8 and 9.
In contrast, Jesus and the old law all through there talking about
that's right.
Complete. So that's the whole thing. That was that point I brought again. The law was never meant to be the end. It was always a in between.
That's right. It always pointed to something else. That's right. That's right.
Which again, shows its temporary nature.
That's right. Let's go to Galatians 3, and there's several verses I want to look at there. Terry?
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Galatians, that's what Paul argues in Galatians 3 and 21.
That's right. That's right. He says, is the law against the promises of God? God forbid. For if there had been a law given which could make alive, verily righteousness would have been of the law. Let's talk about that. If there had been a law given which could make alive, righteousness would have been of the law. Have you ever wondered why didn't God just arrange it where the law was the only system or body of truth that existed between man and God? Why didn't he arrange it that way? Well, again, we read the verse. Is the law against the promises of God? That's the question that he's asking. For if there had been a law given which could make alive, verily righteousness would have been of the law. What's the problem? Why wasn't righteousness prescribed by the law? Was the problem within the law? All right, it was insufficient in that it did not make provision for man once he had sinned. But the problem really wasn't the law. The problem was man because man sinned. Now, once man transgressed the law, now what do we do with him? The law didn't make provision for that. You offer an animal. Well, the animal, as we've learned in Hebrews chapter 10, did not take away sin. It wasn't the animal that sinned. Killing the animal didn't suffice the wrath of God. Terry and then Joey. That's right. And by way of contrast, the priesthood of Christ is unchangeable because he doesn't die. Did I have Joey first and then David?
One question.
I believe I did.
In 21, it says righteousness would have, truly righteousness would have been by the law. And the point he's making is that it wasn't by the law. So I guess, and this is a question, is the author here saying that no set of rules or no law that God could make man righteous because a necessary element to make man truly righteous was the sacrifice of Jesus Christ?
Well, yes and no. I think the one thing that would truly make man righteous is to keep the law. But he didn't keep the law. Now, once he did not keep the law, he's deemed unrighteous by the law, condemned by the law. Now, what can justify him? Well, the law can't do it. Because the law made provisions for condemnation because of sin. It made provision for animal sacrifices, which Hebrews 10 tells us could not do the job completely. So what could? Now we see necessary the blood of Christ. And not just the blood of any man, but the blood of a righteous man had to be offered. The just for the unjust.
The sacrifice of Christ for man's sins goes way back, way before all this. I mean, God the Father knew that ultimately that's what was going to happen. So God knew from the beginning that no man would keep the law. All of sin falls short of the glory of God. It's not like God sat back and watched to see if anybody could keep it, right? I mean, God knew nobody would keep it, right? Hence the plan of Christ to bruise the head of the serpent all the way back in Genesis.
All the way back to Genesis 3, verse 15. So that's right.
Is that assessment accurate? God knew nobody would keep it?
I don't know that I want to take the position that God knew that he has a law here that no man was willing to keep. But God had made provisions should man choose not to keep it. So it was an eternal plan. Yes, Titus chapter 1 tells us that it was a plan in place before things were ever made. David?
There was a plan, but we learned that Christ learned through obedience. Christ still didn't have to make that choice. I mean, the plan was there, but Christ chose not to sacrifice. I mean,
He had that choice all the way through, and thus the
plan, but it didn't mean that it was followed through till it actually did happen.
That's right. Jesus had the choice.
Jesus had the choice.
That's right.
That's why goats and bulls and all that cannot do away with sin. They have no choice when they're sacrificed.
That's right. We do.
They have no choice, period. If man was created and he had no choice, then there couldn't be a righteous man to be sacrificed because there was no choice. The choice is what made him righteous.
All right. All right, I'm going to take two or three more questions or comments, and then we're going back to verse 11 and 12. Yes?
I just want to say that I appreciate you saying that you would not take a stance on the guilt of punishment, because to me that's a mystery.
Yeah.
We say God is omniscient, knows all, has no limitations, but yet instituted a plan that was approved. And if he knew the man of sin would keep the law, how do we reconcile that in our finite mind? We can't. We just have to say his thoughts are too high.
Okay. Well, he said that in Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Okay, David?
Genesis 3:15. It kind of takes me back to the error, and then I don't know if it's correct or not. It's kind of a spectrum of the question. If Adam and Eve had been obedient,
I've heard that question before, David, and the fact is they weren't. And that's where we have to leave that. That's all I know. The rest of it would be speculation. Okay? Well, the fact is they didn't. I don't want to suggest they couldn't, but they didn't. Okay? Al? I didn't hear you, Al.
I said, if what you understand is true, then God is guilty. It wasn't completed. He had to go back and reduce it.
No, I don't want to attribute to God that position.
If it was complete, it was complete. If it wasn't, then he had to go back and bring something up.
Well, the plan was complete. It was complete before time's eternal. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3 begins there, and talks about spiritual blessings being in Christ and all of those things identified according to the plan of God that was eternal. So we don't want to leave God out in the rain and say, well, God messed up. God didn't mess up. He had a way of revealing these things, types and shadows, sorts and kinds, types and anti-types and so forth, in order that man might eventually accept these things to be true. But this was according to the eternal plan of God. God didn't make any mistakes. Right. Right. Okay. That's right. Gary?
In fact, you know, the Old Testament is full of that. Psalms 19 specifically. The law of the Lord is perfect. The law of the Lord is right. It was man's choice to violate that. It wasn't God's imperfect law.
That's
His
right.
The law was perfect. The statutes were just. The statutes were right.
That's right. We don't want to ever attribute the fault to God. It was not God's fault that man didn't keep his law. Man was at fault, and of course the consequences had to be suffered.
It's sort of an odd comparison, but I studied a lot of math in college, and it's like when you're learning a new thing in math, the teacher will tell you the long way to do it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll teach you the way that makes that first way seem a whole lot harder than it was in the first place. But it's to make you understand the easier way better and to make you appreciate it more, because now you see how hard it could be and see how much better you have it now.
Right. That's a simple illustration. Very good. Let's go back to the text. Verse 12. The question has been raised, what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be reckoned after the order of Aaron? In other words, why was it necessary for there to be a different priesthood, a different kind of priesthood? Not the same kind of priesthood. In verse 12, he continues, "For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law." Now, what was the reason that the priesthood itself needed to be changed? What was the function of that Old Testament priesthood? Well, it was to serve as a mediator between man and God, but could he be a perfect mediator? No, he was not a perfect mediator. So now we need a new priesthood, but not just a new priesthood, but a new kind of priesthood.
A new law.
That necessitated a new law. That's right. You couldn't have a new kind of priesthood under that existing law. And why not? Joey?
The priesthood and the law were in and of themselves insufficient to meet the goal, which was complete removal of sin.
Okay, but we've got another reason looming over here.
Number 16:4.
All right, the law had specified a priesthood. And anyone outside the realm of that priesthood could not serve as priest. Okay? God had specified a priesthood. And he had said nothing about priests being from what tribe?
Judah.
Tribe of Judah. Now, in order for Jesus to serve as priest, it was necessary to change the law. Okay? David?
You have another necessity too, though. That is that the law was only for a certain group of people. And so you need a new law and a new priesthood that mankind.
That's right. That's right. All right. Did I see another hand over here? Thought I did. Okay. I did, but it's not. Okay. All right. So we've got a new priesthood. We've got a new law that comes to play. Because it is evident that our Lord has sprung out of Judah, as to which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priests. Let's go back and get verse 13. "For he of whom these things are said belongeth to another tribe, from which no man hath given attendance at the altar." It's true that number 16, verse 40, God specifically forbid anyone other than a descendant of Aaron to serve as high priest. Couldn't be so. Not according to the law. So it was necessary to change the law, especially for one who serves according to the power of an endless life, as we see at verses 15 through verse 17. We'll talk more about that in just a little bit. But it was necessary that the law be changed because Moses spake nothing concerning priests from the tribe of Judah. Now, in our study of the authority class, you remember this particular verse came up frequently because we wanted to recognize that if we are to respect the authority of God, we must respect His authority when He is silent. Silence does not authorize practice. Okay? And we see that evident here. Moses said nothing concerning priests from the tribe of Judah. Could anyone then serve as priest without authority from Moses under that system? Well, no, because Moses was silent about that.
I think it's one of the classes to carry that while he was gone. I didn't talk directly when I talked about it, but I couldn't help think about the so called religion of Judaism today and the disrespect for the silence of God, because the last authority they had, the kingdom of God. Now, assuming, well, we all know that they reject Jesus and they're still supposedly waiting for their Messiah, a Messiah, the only authority they have to govern or officiate their worship is what's in the Old Testament, the Torah or the Old Testament. And they're going to claim to be doing the will of they say God tells them, they're still today going to be doing these sacrifices, the tabernacle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So my question would be, by what authority are you practicing this reform Judaism and all these, you know, Sephardic and
yeah,
different sects?
Well, of course, that's a little foreign from our text, but what we need to note on that is no man today can know what tribe he's from to serve in the capacity of priest in that reference you gave of modern-day Judaism. Can't be so. No man today knows whether he's a Levite or not. The genealogical records were destroyed in AD 70, so it becomes a moot point. Okay? Yes, Gary?
The point he's making here is much like there's no, the question is posed, there's no good answer to who moves either way. It's very similar here. addressing the crowd that was trying to slip back into the old law and accept those things. And he's making the point here that you can't have both of them. Either you have an illegal priesthood or you have an invalid law. So these people can't hold the both. They're going to
Very
have
good.
To choose. And neither answer is the one that they want to make at this point.
That's right. That's right. They don't want to accept the new priesthood, much less the new law. That's right. All right. In verse 15, it says, "And what we say is yet more abundantly evident, if after the likeness of Melchizedek there ariseth another priest, who hath been made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life." We've got a new priesthood. We've got a different kind of priest. We've got a change in the priesthood, signifying a change in the law. And especially it says, while indicating that one serves according to the power of an endless life. The Levitical priests were simply mortal men. Their service ended at death. But Jesus is a priest forever, and his priesthood, therefore, according to verse 24, is unchangeable. Now, with the change in the priesthood, the law becomes annulled. Do we see that? The law is no more effective. Terry? All right.
Understanding what verse 11 is teaching, that the law stands or falls on the Levitical priesthood. So the priesthood is changed, and that means that the law is changed.
That's right. Has to be so.
It has to be so.
There's no other alternative. Okay? And as Gary pointed out, that's the hinge pin that they don't want to accept. Okay? Correct.
Right. It just said what tribe could serve. And the point is, that statement in and of itself rules out all the other tribes.
That's right.
So it didn't specifically say a man from Judah cannot serve.
Didn't have to.
Yet we learned from the scriptures that it didn't have to, because it did specify Levites, which necessarily rules out all the others. And I think that's worth noting, because that's a fine example of the concept of the authority of the scriptures.
All right. True.
Well,
oh yes, which illustrates with King Uzziah, who was of the tribe of Judah. He was a king, but he had no right to officiate in the temple. Okay? All right, I want to go back to verse 15 and ask you a question. In verse 15 it says, "And what we say is yet more abundantly evident." This expression, he's identifying something that is more abundantly evident. What is it? The writer's trying to make it clear. Something is more abundantly evident. Well, I think you've said it earlier. The priesthood and all that pertain to it, even the law, it's more abundantly evident that these things are to end. If after the likeness of Melchizedek there ariseth another priest, if another priest arises, then it becomes more abundantly evident that the law and everything that pertained to it would cease. It would have to be so. And then in verse 16, "Who hath been made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life." Those Old Testament priests were made priests based upon certain physical requirements, the law of a carnal commandment. But Christ was made priest after the power of an endless life. In other words, he serves as priest forever, not based upon physical circumstances. His priesthood is endless or imperishable. Yes, Randy? Yes, oh yes.
There is no law attached to it.
Melchizedek was before the law.
That's what I mean. The Levitical priesthood is attached to the law of Moses, which was given to the Jews. The Melchizedek priesthood, as far as we know, I'm speculating,
Yes.
As a priest of the Most High God, that's all we know.
That's right.
But we can assume that that wasn't for the Jews, because the Jews didn't occupy Salem.
They didn't exist at the time.
No, I just mean that Abraham's people didn't occupy Salem at the time.
Okay.
He was the king of Salem, but who lived in Salem?
He was not a descendant of Abraham. So he was
not a descendant of Abraham.
That's right. That's right. He was never a Jew. Of course, he existed before there was any such thing as a Jew.
But a priest of the Most High God, we don't know who he was a priest for.
Well, what we learn about Melchizedek is found in only three places. Here in the book of Hebrews and in Psalms 119 and in Genesis 14. So what we know about Melchizedek is very brief.
I guess I'm just trying to draw whatever.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And of course, then it brings us to verse 17. For it is witnessed of him, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now in verse 18 it says, for there is a disannulling of a foregoing commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness. A disannulling. What's that mean? What happened to the foregoing commandment? We're not just talking about the priesthood, but everything that pertained to it. The law of Moses. Setting aside, that's right. And why?
Its weakness and its unprofitableness.
Its weakness and unprofitableness. In what way?
It's inadequate and insufficient to do the job, which is the real goal is complete forgiveness and removal of sins.
All right. All right, Terry. That's right.
And it's teaching the recipients of this letter, making the point to them that you're trying to return to a system of law that's been voided out and abrogated.
That's right. All right. Go ahead.
I need an English verse. Annulled, if you get your marriage annulled, then your marriage is void, right?
Okay. All right, let's ask Randy if he'll read to us from his translation, see if it uses that particular word. It's in verse 18, Hebrews 7, verse 18. Annulling, okay. Setting aside. Okay. All right, does that help? It's just simply setting aside. We'll stick with that then. Okay, Terry? That's right. It's been abrogated. David?
Under the old law, so that means the ones who were faithful and died going on before, as it were, had to wait till the time of Christ.
Well, now let's talk about that. That raises an interesting something that needs to be discussed just a little bit. You're saying that those under the law had to wait then until the time of Christ before their sins could be forgiven. Well, let's talk about this illustration that Terry used a few moments ago about a debt and paying the interest on the debt, the principal. Does the bank foreclose on the principal as long as the interest is paid? Okay.
It all depends on the terms of the loan.
All right. Now let's put that analogy with what we're talking about here. When we talk about the principle of sin, does God call in the debt just any moment? Or as long as the animal sacrifices are offered, does God continue to extend, in a sense, forgiveness of sins? But the debt is not stamped paid in full until the principal is paid, that is, with the blood of Christ. Okay, so suggesting they're hanging around somewhere, waiting, I don't see that at all.
No, not waiting, but when we talk about the principal paying the debt,
That's right. Sins were not in fact forgiven without the blood of Christ. And that brings us to the Hebrew letter where it, in the ninth chapter, where it tells us that the blood covered those who had offered the blood of animals as well as you and I on this side of the cross. Okay, we'll talk some more about that. It's on the left-hand page, the right-hand column, about halfway down.